your soup.
It's the Paradox edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, praying for poo, national extinction, caffeine and cancer, and the prison paradox. Let's begin episode 130.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
I'm Jenna, your biochemist. So, boys, I hear that Canada isn't willing to shell out some cash to go on a trip.
What? Where to?
That would be the 2012 World Fair being held in South Korea. So the organizers sent an invitation, but our feds have RSVP'd that we will not be in attendance.
You see, this is just another example of the Harper government trying to spoil the fun of Canadians. I mean, here we have a chance to go to a fair, and they
a
say
fair.
No. So what exactly is the World Fair?
So, as far as my understanding is, I've been to a World Fair when I was, I think, four.
Would you recall from this experience?
I think it was mostly the inside of one of the child carriers, but it's where a bunch of countries that are invited from all over the world are invited to put up their pavilions and showcase the things about their culture that they think are really special and give everybody an opportunity to experience these things. And so we have declined the invitation based on financial reasons, and we are only one of two countries to do that, the other being Greece, who, you know, is having such a financial lovely time right now. But as it turns out, the reason that the government has said this is because Canada's booth isn't particularly popular.
What?
I know! You'd think that people would be tripping over themselves to get to the Canada booth. You know, those of Japan and the US, you know, they're raking it in. But apparently global citizens aren't able to put a finger on what makes us Canadians unique enough to head over to their pavilion.
But I thought one of the big points of us having the Olympics and all that was to raise our image. I mean, we even had a riot that became international news. I mean, should that make us more popular?
Yeah, you'd think, but you know, London, they just one-upped us on the riot thing. And there's going to be another Olympics any day now?
Bloody British.
Yeah, jerks.
However, in other news, which is quite unique, and I don't know if this will, you know, make people want to go anywhere in particular, but there's praying for poo. This is not a story about a miracle cure for constipation or some agrarian cult hoping to increase the fertility of their fields. No. Apparently some Tuscan friars asked God to deliver diarrhea for Basilica Bible theft. A group of Franciscan friars are furious at the theft of Bibles from their church in Florence and have taken the unusual step of praying that the thieves be struck down with diarrhea.
So, that specifically, hey?
Yes. Well, it gets better. So, I mean, to be fair, there is just cause for their anger. The friars at the 15th century church of San Salvador El Monte, which was a favorite, apparently, of Michelangelo, if that's important, were irritated when a rare and expensive Bible disappeared from a lectern. They flew off the handle when a replacement Bible, which was donated by some worshippers, went missing within hours. So a note was pinned in full view of all the worshippers, and the friars say that they hope the thief sees the error of his ways, but in case he does not, they added, quote, "We pray to God that the thief is struck down by a strong bout of the shits." End quote. Now, I'm assuming this was originally done in Italian, so the quote is a translated quote. But one of the friars apparently says, it's not exactly clean language, but we couldn't put up with it any longer, and the Lord and the faithful will understand. I just This is such a human response to such an event. And you just, I'm picturing, you know, little guys in gray suits, you know, the gray hair, you know, going around and saying, "Ooh, I hope that guy gets a bad case of the shits."
No, no, no. First, they hope he sees the error of his ways. That one was written first. They're very fair, these friars.
That's true, that's true.
They've come a long way since the Inquisition.
Well, you know, and actually thinking about it, Yeah, in the same lines, right? I mean, what you know, God would strike you down with lightning or whatever, right? I mean, has faith been so diminished that the best you can hope for now is a bad case of the runs?
Okay, you can die from a bad case of the runs, and I suspect that it is worse than a bolt of lightning.
Well, having experienced one and not the other, I must admit, it's hard for me to judge, but at the same time, in Italy has modern medicine. Very few people die from dehydration because of...
Well, it depends on which part of Italy. The south is significantly more poor than the north.
And how you're really defining a bad case of the shits.
I must admit, a wholly inspired case of the runs might be of, well, flood potential, but...
Okay. Have you guys ever wondered when countries will go extinct?
Well, didn't a few of them go extinct during the war? And I know you can put any war in there, but I think...
Yeah, I suppose. But no, actually, The Economist did a story on the projections of fertility and birth rates of women in countries all over the world, and they came up with this idea, this chart, of when certain countries are going to go extinct. So they took Hong Kong as an example, and a cohort of 1,000 women... these 1,000 women are expected to give birth to 547 daughters, and then if nothing changed, those 547 daughters would be succeeded by 299 daughters, and so on and so on. And then if you sort of extrapolate wildly, it would take only 25 generations for Hong Kong's female population to shrink from 3.75 million to just one. So these extrapolations are based on...
1 million or one person?
One person. Ooh. Yeah. And these extrapolations are based on a number of marriages, the number of children the couples are having, other birth-related factors. And, you know, these are pretty sort of wild extrapolations. They could easily change if there was some sort of cultural shift in the future. But by the same logic, they looked at other countries as well. Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, and Spain will be extinct by the next millennium. China has only 1,500 years left. Interesting enough, Canada and Brazil were estimated to survive the longest.
Then who'll be rocking the world fair?
Exactly. Canada wouldn't go extinct until the year 4050, and Brazil would last to the year 5000.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, when I was looking at this, right, I mean, I guess you say this is kind of a weird thing to do, and
I'm sure there's weird.
But then, you know, the little guy in the back of my head who goes, wait a minute, maybe there's more to this than meets the eye. And forgive me, but one of the things I was thinking of is if you're talking about the extinction of a country, really what you mean is the extinction of the culture of that country. Because most one of the confounding factors, of course, is immigration, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you get more people coming into your country that will alter these numbers quite a bit. And then I was thinking, maybe this is someone's way of sort of sitting there saying, listen, we have to be worried about all these immigrants because pretty soon our country is going to cease to exist and these other people will take it over.
Well, I mean, this is, I think, kind of a jokey story a little bit, but this sort of thinking was actually quite commonplace back in the early 20th century. In particular, France had a long history of kind of constant fear of de-Francing. Basically, immigrants would come in, take over, and not enough French ladies were having babies, and they would even give out awards for French ladies who had, like, 10 kids or something. It was quite the display. So
the Deca moms.
Yeah.
It even goes back, if you go back another century before that, one of the reasons why England created so many colonies out there is because England's defense was based upon the Navy, and you didn't need as many people to man the Navy, whereas a country like France and those had land armies, and they didn't want immigration out of the country because they wanted all the men to stay at home to fight the wars against all the other European countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's it kind of actually sort of reminds me of a lot of the sort of old style sort of racism and xenophobia. And it does kind of pop up every now and then. You know, here locally, you get stories about, oh, there's too many people coming into Canada and we're losing our cultural identity. If people even assume Canada has a cultural identity, as
seems to get last.
World Fair indicates we don't. So, I don't know. Well, kind of strange.
There was another thing, too, this is on the heels of, is I think it's this month or within, you know, a number of days that the world's population hit 7 billion. I think it's 7 billion, which is a landmark. So, again, you know, these countries going extinct. And I mean, how can they go extinct if we have more people on the planet now than we've ever had in our entire life?
Yeah, I was just about to comment on how, you know, seems a little peculiar how things can swing so far from talking about overpopulation to suddenly using words like extinction.
Yeah, well, hopefully Canada won't go extinct anytime soon. Why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Jenna, you're going to be telling us a bit about cancer and caffeine.
I am. So, you know, every once in a while you get these crazy claims in the paper, and you get certain, you know, reports of things that you have a right to be skeptical about. You know, things like scientists find a correlation between people that eat bacon and net income. This sounds like a pretty good correlation to me. But sometimes this correlation really does play out, and sometimes it doesn't. But I gotta say, it is a lot more convincing from a scientific standpoint when the study is able to offer an exact and testable mechanism for how it's proposed to work. So this is the case in a new study that has actually found that caffeine has a protective effect against skin cancer.
But Bullpuck. I don't believe that. How could possibly? I mean, what does it make the cancer cells so hyper that they kill themselves? I mean, what? How do?
I think you might be so surprised just how not far off the mark you are. So before we talk a lot about, you know, what caffeine has to do with cancer, I think we should talk a little bit about what cancer actually is and what causes it, because one of the things that really irks me as far as cancer reporting in the media is when people are talking about curing cancer, which is a lovely idea and impossible. Treating cancer is a fantastic idea and definitely possible, but curing cancer isn't something we should really be discussing. And as we'll talk about, it's not something that you can sort of eliminate forever from the human body like you can with something like polio, because it's really an innate part of being made of more than one cell.
Well, and it's also the type of thing, too, when you say cure cancer, it's like saying you could cure disease. You know, I mean, there isn't a cancer. There are cancers in
it's true, but they all have the same basic mechanism.
Ooh.
So you'd think that, you know, there might be a way to go around it, but really, getting cancer, you don't catch cancer. You develop cancer, and every multicellular organism pretty much can develop a type of cancer. So let's talk about what it actually is. So when you have cancer, you have, you know, when we talk about tumors and that kind of thing, you basically have a growth. And what this really is uncontrolled cellular growth. And on a cellular level, what that means is that the cells are dividing really fast. And the reason that you get these sort of sick-looking, messed-up cells is because they're dividing too fast to actually let their quality control mechanisms take effect. So you're dividing so quickly and reproducing your DNA so quickly that you're introducing a lot of mistakes that make really messed-up cells.
So one of the main principles behind a cancer cell is its sort of suicide capacity, its ability to say, hey, there's something wrong with me, therefore I'm going to sort of kill myself. The, what is it? Word we use last word?
apoptosis.
That's
so they don't do that.
Right. And because they don't do that because of cancer cell, because they're cancerous, other errors, which would normally trigger their suicide, still will sort of trigger the suicide, but the suicide mechanism is, the self-destruct mechanism is gone.
Yeah.
So when other errors occur...
And not only the self-destruct mechanism, which is one of the ways that you control uncontrolled growth, but just you have certain cellular checkpoints that you have to pass saying, okay, everything's honky-dory, we can divide now. And these sort of get bypassed. You just get this really crazy uncontrolled growth. So how does this get set off? Well, as we know, we have lots and lots and lots of genes in our body that are useful for all kinds of things. Now, there's one class of gene that's called, we term an oncogene, and onco means cancer. So this is sort of a gene that, if it's mutated, can cause cancer. And typically these genes tend to be, the types of, the products of the genes tend to be things that help regulate the cell. So you break down those regulation mechanisms, and that's what causes this uncontrolled growth. So that's an oncogene. And you can get cancer if you mutate your oncogenes. So, obviously, we want to keep our DNA accurate and intact in regular everyday life. And there are also various things, not only that control the way that the cell is moving through the cell cycle and dividing, but things that actually help repair the DNA. There's DNA repair machinery that's going to help us to maintain as few mutations in the DNA as possible. And to control these DNA repair machines, there are other cellular components that detect when there's DNA damage and basically signal to the DNA repair machines to get to work repairing the DNA. So
we have the one mechanism where its self-destruct mechanism is gone defunct. And then you have
self-destruct mechanism.
But that's one.
We'll call it uncontrolled growth.
Okay.
We have irregulated growth. And another mechanism we're talking about is a way to maintain our DNA and maintain it, you know, with the sequence the same way that our parents had it, such that, you know, it's all honky-dory. So where does caffeine come into this? Caffeine is a small molecule, and it interacts with one of the enzymes that is in the signaling pathway that tells the DNA machine or DNA repair machinery to fix the DNA. So basically, when caffeine interacts with it, it's unable to pass on the message, and the DNA repair enzymes don't get the signal, and the DNA stays damaged. So this eventually results in those self-destruct mechanisms getting activated, and basically the whole cell just self-destructs in a process that, like we said, is called apoptosis. It's basically cellular suicide.
So what you're saying, sorry, I hate to be the thick one here, but, you know, it's a role I play so well. So we have the caffeine interferes with the self-repair mechanism.
Yep.
Of the cell.
No, it's not so much a self-repair mechanism as a DNA repair mechanism.
DNA. And because you've interfered with this DNA repair mechanism, this somehow hinders cancers from occurring.
We're going to get into it. You got to go baby steps.
Baby steps, Dawn.
Stop jumping ahead. So the specific enzyme that caffeine binds to actually acts at one of those cellular checkpoints. So it is making sure that all the DNA is intact before the cell decides to divide. So if it's just hanging out the cell with no plans to divide, like your average circulating white blood cell or something like that, then this mechanism doesn't really come into play. But if you are something like an epithelial cell on your skin that reproduces really rapidly, then that cellular checkpoint is going to be gone through a lot more often, and the caffeine is going to have a much greater effect. So we talked about how when caffeine interacts, what we actually get is cellular death. So how is cellular death actually a good thing? So although the DNA repair machinery is able to repair the DNA physically, so basically stitching together the frayed ends of a rope, so to speak, for some types of damage, you can't actually be sure that the DNA sequence is actually the same as what it was before the damage. And obviously the sequence is what carries the information.
So when they sew together the frayed ends as you use it, if they use the wrong color thread, sometimes it causes...
Exactly. So for some types of damage, you can repair it so it's exactly like it was before. And for some types of damage, some of which are caused by UV radiation, there's no way to for the enzymes to know what the sequence was before. And so they just kind of have to stick some random nucleotides in there and hope that either, you know, you have a 1 in 4 chance per nucleotide that it's going to be replaced the same as it was before, or that it's in a part of a protein that isn't that important, which there's lots of spots like that. However, if this is in an oncogene, as we were talking about, a single mutation in an oncogene can actually be the very beginning of cancer. So that first mutation, the first oncogene, is going to cause that cell to then proliferate in an uncontrolled way and make a whole bunch of clones of itself that quickly become uncloned because of mutation. But that is what causes the cancer. So if the DNA gets repaired and the cell divides, then you have a change in sequence at one of those oncogenes. It might not be an oncogene, but it could be. Then that is the start of cancer. But if the DNA doesn't get repaired, because caffeine is inhibiting the whole mechanism, then the cell will sense, oh, that DNA is not repaired, we can't divide, so we'll just die. And so it actually kills the cancer cell before it even becomes cancerous.
Okay, so big question. Does that mean that caffeine is good for preventing cancer or for helping slow down cancer?
For preventing cancer. So this is the first event that is sort of the start of cancer. You can call an oncogene sort of like a proto-cancerous gene because you need it to work when it's not mutated, and it's when it's mutated that you have a problem. So by preventing that one gene from becoming screwed up, because instead of that cell ever having any lineage, it just dies. And then you don't have 2 and then 4 and then 8 of these messed up cells. You have 0 because it's dead. But once it's already going, you can't repair that with the caffeine.
Well, and that's the thing. So once the bad repair job is done, the cell is whole again, and it keeps reproducing poorly, in a bad way. But it's a whole cell.
Yeah.
Whereas with the caffeine prevents it from being whole again, and therefore it kills itself.
Right, because the checkpoint cellular machinery that's checking for DNA damage isn't checking the sequence. It's not saying, oh my goodness, do I think, you know, let me do the math, is this going to produce a functional protein? No, it's saying, is it 2 strands of twisted DNA that are all together, or does it have a nick or a break, or is it all frayed? Is it broken? And so it's not going to be able to detect a sequential error, just a physical damage.
Okay, so another question. How much caffeine should I be taking to prevent cancer?
Well, if I remember correctly, it was they did the study in women, and 1 cup of coffee a day changed the... It had an effect of about 7% or something like that over your lifetime of preventing skin cancer.
Wow.
I thought in that same study, because I may be misremembering, that if he had like 6 cups a day, the effect was...
It was something like 20% at 6 cups a day. Now, there are negative effects to caffeine, so I'm not telling anyone to go and have 6 cups of coffee a day, but...
I was going to suggest 60. Then you'd be guaranteed never
Ramp
to get cancer
up.
Again.
Well, no, you'd be guaranteed not to get epithelial skin cancer, and you'd get caffeine-induced cancer in your kidneys or something.
I wonder if you could use this as sort of, you know how intelligent design uses the idea of irreducible complexity to say, hey, look, this had to be, you know, planned. If we could sort of use the incompetency of this system as sort of a counter to see, this proves that it couldn't have been designed, or if the designer was there, he was incompetent or an idiot or something. Because the whole repair mechanism, as you kind of described it, strikes me as pretty half-ass. I mean, it works mostly.
Lazy God.
Yeah.
Oh, Don, if you were an enzyme, you wouldn't call it half-ass. So, they're really doing their best.
So does this open the door for like a pseudoscience sunscreen company to start putting caffeine in sunscreen?
I actually do think that there is some effect with topical application that is actually smearing it
really?
On your skin. I hope I'm not pulling that out of my nether regions. But I believe I read that. So, I mean, it's entirely possible, but I'm chalking it right up under the same banner as my one, you know, healthy glass of wine a day too, although as a woman it's not as helpful, but anyhow, everything in moderation, And sometimes you find some really unexpected results of some things that you might think are negative.
You know, and this just sort of proves one of the points that we often mention is, I mean, you can have some pretty weird and wild theories out there or whatever, right? And maybe this was, quote unquote, an alternative, I don't want to say cure, because again, that's not the right word, an alternative treatment. But I mean, it would have remained to be wacky and perhaps crazy until you do the scientific evidence. And once it's sort of proven, it's no longer alternative. It is medicine. It is actual treatment.
A prophylactic. And yes, this is actually how this study progressed. Is from the mechanistic study that we've been talking about, and how caffeine is actually able to interact with this one enzyme that messes up the pathway that causes the eventual apoptosis. This was sort of spearheaded after other studies where they saw a correlation between caffeine consumption and lower skin cancer rates. So it's good to see that, again, when those sort of correlations come up that seem a little sketchy, that you're able to look into it a little deeper.
All right, well, let's go to a commercial break on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back with more after this.
Hi, this is Perry from the Templars. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Oi, oi.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, tell us about prisons.
Well, the prison paradox. Prior to the election, the Harper government announced that it was planning a huge spending project to increase the capacity of Canadian prisons. This got me to wonder. I've had numerous discussions and debates with friends about the quote-unquote crime problem, as I didn't see that we had one. According to every stat that I could find, the crime rate has been dropping since the 90s. If the crime rate has been dropping, then why do we need more prisons? First, we should address the issue. Is the crime rate really going down, or is this just some aberration of statistics? According to Stats Canada, the crime rate breaks down kind of like this. All these numbers are per 100,000 population. So for all crime, in 1960, there were 2,771 instances. In 77, it was 5,038. In 91, it was 7,219. In 2006, we were down to 4,539. Even the homicide rate has gone down quite a bit. In the 60s, it was 1.3 homicides per 100,000. 75, 3.03, that was sort of a peak. 91 was 2.7. In 2006, we were down to 1.9.
And that is per capita as well.
That's all per 100,000 population.
Right.
So they're not based on raw counts. They're based on what are your odds if you're in 100,000 number of people,
right,
of you having a crime, violent crime, homicide. The numbers also show that in 2009, the crime rate was down 17%, was 17% lower than it was a decade ago. There is also a 20% decrease in the crime severity index. The crime severity index takes into account not only the change in volume of a particular crime, but also the relative seriousness of that crime in comparison to other crimes, so as that more serious crimes carry a greater weight than less serious. Now, this particular measurement in itself has only been around since, I think, 1999, so it's harder to go back for historical comparisons on this one, but it's still a useful index. Although it is true that when compared to 1960s, the number of crime is high. However, since the early 90s, there has been a decade, there has been a decrease in both violence and property crime. It also seems that the crime rate is and has been for a decade or more consistently going down. It has also been claimed by those who are quote-unquote tough on crime types that crime is really going up, but the police forces and politicians manipulate the number so as to ensure a perception of decreasing crime. Now, I find there are a couple of logical errors with this thinking. One, it is in the interest of both law enforcement and the quote-unquote tough-on-crime politicians to have the stats show an increase in crime, not decrease, so as to justify increases in funding and re-elections and that sort of thing. So, I mean, it's in their own vested interest to try and make it sound scary out there. Vote for me, I will make our society more safe. Look how horrible it is right now. And you just kind of echo that sentiment.
Seems like it would depend on what point in the election cycle you're at for that type of logic, because I can see, you know, toward the end of your term, you might want to say, yay, crime's down.
But once you say that, then it's like, well, okay, you've done your job, thank you. Now I can worry about the second or third issue, like unemployment or healthcare or something.
Darn those pesky issues.
Yeah. But another problem with it as well is that the number of all crimes, so this isn't the categories, this is all the crimes, are also declining regardless of their breakdown. So even the raw numbers still show a decrease per 100,000 in the actual crime rate.
So I don't really know enough about this field to make any sort of judgment about the accuracy of the numbers or how they're arrived at. But it does seem that people are right to approach these sorts of statistics with some sort of skepticism. Precisely because the ability for someone in the general public to go through and test the numbers and come up with their own stats seems pretty much limited. Especially with these enormous overarching categories, you know, all crime, violent crime. It seems to me that shifting the definitions of those categories and sort of nudging the numbers in one direction or another can't be that difficult. So I think this is important, as the numbers are really powerful communication tools and people really listen to numbers.
Well, I know one of the things, there's sort of an absolute number about these, because the crime reporting rate is based upon actual court cases. So in that sense, there's no sort of fiddling with the figures in that sense. But you are right. I mean, what counts for violent assault, right? In the United States, they've got like one category of violent assault. In Canada, we have like assault with a deadly weapon, assault with intent to harm, and like there's three or four subcategories that we use, and those definitions will change over time. So you're right, these subcategories can become quite blurry. But again, the overall figures still hold kind of.
The subcategories would be able to influence the greater figures as well when you're thinking of things like, you know, if they're based on things that are coming to court, what are we deciding to bring to court? Are we bringing, you know, traffic offenses? Are we bringing marijuana offenses? Are we bringing, you know?
Actually, that's a good point. And in all these numbers that I mentioned, they make explicit that traffic cases aren't included. Although I imagine traffic cases involving homicide would, you know, if you run somebody over. So they're not including that. But you are right in the one sense that homicide rate and what qualifies as a homicide versus involuntary manslaughter and all that is one of the numbers that's easy to manipulate for political or image issues, right?
Well, I think that a lot of traffic, quote-unquote, crimes are bylaws anyway and wouldn't be classified under criminal unless there was some level of criminal negligence or activity involved with the particular car crime thing. But I also think it's kind of interesting to look at the sociological situation of the stats from different decades. So, like, for example, you know, in the 60s, when spousal abuse was not really considered a public issue, or violence against minorities was generally unreported and kind of ignored. So you sort of get a certain dimension to these numbers, and even for our modern day number, we have to keep in mind what crimes are not getting added to these numbers as well. I mean, we have to assume, I think, that there's a lot of crime that happens that just isn't getting reported, perhaps because it's being visited upon people who don't really have a lot of access to law enforcement, or they're in a vulnerable position, or for whatever other reason. So it is possible that these numbers are wrong, but you know, it's really hard to track that.
I find it interesting. In the one sense, you know, the idea of the 1960s when the crime rate was really, really low, there may have been a lot more of, as you put it, underreporting, because things that were considered violent acts now weren't considered criminal offenses back then. But I mean, a lot of the shift, the decline in the rates are based on the 90s. And if anything, we've had an increase in what we consider to be crime. So you'd expect the numbers to go up. So things like hate crime and a child abuse or pedophilia and all that sort of thing, there's been a much more increased emphasis on those. And yet we still see a decrease in the overall numbers, even if we do take into effect the sociological aspects of it. And the other aspect, which is very interesting, was one of the things that Stockwell Day had brought up when he was announcing this bill and all that, was he kept announcing unreported crimes are on the increase. But the problem with using that statistic, and I'm not denying that there can't be unreported crimes out there, but almost by their very nature, you can't know how many they are because they are unreported. And yeah, although we may, as a society, make a stronger effort to try and be inclusive so that all crime is reported in one way or another, until you get to that step, I mean, even if, let's say, okay, so it's unreported crime, and let's say the crime rates are going up, we're dealing here with prisons. If it's unreported, they ain't going to prison because it's an unreported crime. So again, it doesn't quite fit neatly into this picture.
Right, definitely.
So, if crime rates aren't going down, why are there cries for increased prison capacity? Well, one explanation is the lack of investment in infrastructure. That is, old prisons may be decommissioned or in a state of disrepair so as they cannot hold the same number of prisons as before. However, most of the complaints issued by Canada's prison ombudsman, which we apparently have, and he had a big report a couple of years ago, were not about the bricks and mortar of the building, but in the support services, most notably in mental health and addiction programs. Other concerns, and actually I didn't think of this, is inadequate training of staff that leads to increased incidents of quote-unquote inappropriate violence to subdue prisoners. So another area where the stats kind of get pushed to the side, and you're mentioning social issues, is a number of people who are being incarcerated are being incarcerated not because they are so much criminals, but because of mental issues. We no longer have the facilities in mental institutions to help them, and they get pushed into the prison system in that sense. But let's look at the actual numbers here. In 2010, the number of prisons, according to StatsCan, was 71,417. But at any one moment, there are only about 20,000 convicts in prison. This discrepancy is accounted for by the fact that one person is released from prison while another is incarcerated, so that there were 71,000 people flowing through the system, but with only about 20,000 incarcerated at any one moment. Actually, the incarceration rate itself is actually down by over 10% since its high point in the mid-90s. However, the actual prison population, not to confuse issues, is 38,348 in 2009 numbers. And the additional population arises not from convicts, but from those people who are remanded into custody, usually while they await sentencing. This number has actually increased by over 30% over the same time period.
Don, does that include people that are in the drunk tank?
Ooh. Yes, I think it would. Yeah, because again, there's a large classification of what's remanded and that sort of thing. So these are people who are not convicted of a crime. They weren't actually sentenced, so they're not technically prisoners. They're not actually convicts, but they are actually taking up space in a prison cell while they're being held.
So you're trying to tell me it spikes during spring break?
Yeah, I guess it would.
So are the extra people then, are they the ones who are currently going into court for trials?
Well, some of them are. Some of them get released because the charges were dropped.
Mm, right.
Some of them, again, like you mentioned, the drunk tank, they're more there as a sort of semi-form of incarceration. You know, you don't really have a legal thing, but it's best to get them off the street because they may cause harm to themselves. So if we take this number and we compare it to the estimated capacity of our prison system, which is roughly 38,284, we actually do have we're over capacity, only by about 100 people, but If you factor in the increase remand rates and the distribution of cells compared to location of crimes, we could see that there is at least a case for a minor increase in the number of prisons.
So if I'm following the numbers correctly, then the bottom line is that our current actual headcount for people behind bars, I counted while you were talking, is very, very, very close, like less than 1% off of the number of people the system is trying to put behind bars. So basically the current prisons are really, really, really close to being sufficient?
Right. So like I say, there does seem to be some justification to either A, increase the number of prison cells by a small amount, or B, and this was one of the things that a lot of prison advocacy groups point out, is the number of people who are being held without charge, so to speak, right? You know, the people who are being remanded, who are waiting, has skyrocketed over that period. And part of that is, you know, we can say, well, maybe it's police overusing their authority. But as we sort of reduce funding to the court system, as opposed to the prison system, it is taking more and more time for cases to come to trial, which means people are hanging out in prison longer than they would without actually being convicted.
Is it possible, too, that the system is the same as so many others, where if you build it, they will come and we'll pretty much fill whatever prisons we got?
That is an interesting case. But before I cover that question, I just to highlight what I'm talking about is in Quebec, I think it was about a year ago, the public attorneys of the province went on strike because they said they were being overworked and underpaid for what they're doing. And because they're being overworked, what they do is they go into the court, they say, well, can I get a continuance because I haven't had enough time to prepare for this case? And again, it expands the amount of time people go in there. And in the United States, there is a huge, huge, huge controversy over the idea of private prisons. I don't think we have any private prisons in Canada. I'm not sure about that, but I'm pretty sure we don't. But in the United States, a growing amount of prisoners are actually in private prisons. And while they're in private prisons, they actually are put to work to build things as it's factory labor, but they get paid horribly. In Canada, for example, in 1981, the daily wage for a prisoner, those who can get some form of work in the prison system, was $7.55. Now, they can take that money and they get to go to the sort of the canteen where they can buy smokes or whatever, right?
Licorice!
Yeah, and so the sort of consumer price index, the basket of things an average prisoner would buy in that time was about $6.81. So, you know, they were making a little bit more than they would spend on an average day. But in 2007, their daily wage was actually only $6.90. But that same basket of goods was $61.81. So, and again, you get this sort of perpetuation of, you know, they can't afford the slave labor. And again, I don't think that's a big issue in Canada yet, but in the United States, it has become a huge, huge issue. A Arizona judge was just recently convicted of sentencing minors to prison because he was getting kickbacks from the private prison company.
Strong young backs.
Well, let's go to a commercial break, and we'll finish up with prisons after this here on Radio Freethinker.
I'm this guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star. But planet is just another speck. To think about all of this. To think about the vast.
Radio Freethinker is heard Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Freethinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Freethinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
We're all connected to each other.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there.
Ah!
astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we're back. So when we left, we were talking about the prison paradox, and we've gone into a lot of bit about the capacity out of our prisons. But we still haven't answered the main question. Where are all these criminals coming from? Well, one factor is that the crime rate may be lowering, but the actual number of crimes can still increase due to population growth. Canada's population has almost doubled since the 60s. So in absolute terms, the number of crimes can actually increase. In 2010, the number of crimes was 2,095,921 compared to 2,023,558 in 1991, our peak year for crime. Another factor is the length of sentencing. As mentioned already, there is a flow of people going into and getting out of prison. As sentence length increases, the number of those remaining in prison increase and thus inflate the number of the incarcerated, even if the actual number of crimes decreases. In 1984, the median prison stay was 28 days compared to 36 days in 2009, an increase of almost 30%. Another factor in the growing number is the growing number of narco prisoners. Those are people who are convicted of selling drugs, incarcerated for various drug-related crimes. These fall outside of the regular violent or property crime, but what I would classify in an admittedly biased way as moral crimes. The number of people convicted of drug crimes has increased, almost doubling, with a rate, almost doubling since the beginning of the stats, with a rate increasing 37%.
So I do take issue with your seeming classification of violent crimes as not morally regulated, apparently, but I'll skip over that as it's a little bit tangential. But I would like to point out that the increasing drug crimes is a little bit irrelevant in the context of prison numbers in total, if the total number of crimes are going down. So it's skewing the prison demographic, but that is, of course, unless prisoners for these offenses are somehow affecting the length of stay in prison for themselves or for others. Is there any evidence that increasing sort of incarceration for drug crimes is affecting the overall prison dynamic in a way that puts a greater strain on the system?
Yes and to no. So in the one sense, there is when we talk about the stats, and we mentioned before how we break out, we have violent crime, we have property crime, and often they say one of the subcategories is decreasing. And I know we're going back onto this. Whereas drug crime seems to be kept out as a separate thing. So again, even if violent crime or property crime is on the decrease, we may have an increase in prisoners because of an increase in drug-related crimes. But you're right, the overall crime stats should reflect that, and that's where we started off with this from. But where drug crime can have a a noticeable impact is in the idea of minimum sentencing, another thing that has been strongly promoted by the Conservative government, among others, that these, I would classify moral crimes because most of them, I think, are, there is no victim like you would have in a violent crime. Yes, I know that is a
horror. Oh, jeez.
A bed of snakes that we could get into later. So the idea being, though, is that because there's minimum sentencing being pushed for all these, the length of stay is being also increased greatly. So again, as I say, one of the ways that you can actually have fewer crimes but more people in prison is that they're staying longer and they're overlapping in their sentences that wouldn't have happened before.
There's also the issue of drug crimes sort of filling up prisons. So if you have, like in the U.S., you have a lot of people who are in prison for what might be considered minor offenses, possession of marijuana or something, and they're being locked up with, you know, potentially hardened criminals, which could potentially make it difficult for them to get rehabilitated when they leave prison. And there's sort of this idea that you're actually making them better criminals by locking them up with professional criminals, so to speak.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, there are some statistics, and I don't have anything in my hand, so don't make me be too specific, but about addiction problems coming out of prison where there might not have been so many going in.
Well, and that goes back to one of the things that the ombudsman was mentioning, is that we seem to have this thing that we lock them up and they're out of society and we can ignore them because we're never going to see them again. But then that's not true, because while they're in there, they are developing, and quite often, poor social habits, addiction, HIV infection, all those sort of things. And then when they come back into society, they have these negative things that will color how they reinteract with society.
And probably make them both more vulnerable to, falling into crime themselves, as well as greater dangers to society, as well as more... socioeconomically disadvantaged within that society.
You know, in an odd sort of way, some people will say that the reason for the decrease in crime rates, these very sort of tough on crime people who say, well, the crime rate's always going up, but they may say, well, it's actually that their tough stance is the reason for this. So in order to check this out, and this is a very sort of loose analysis I did, I tried to see whether this was sort of correlation or causation. I went and I checked the prison populations versus crime rates to see if there's any link. I chose the U.S. as my lab, one, because the numbers are easy to get, and the various states have very different crime rates and incarceration rates, which makes it an easy sort of quick judge. The two highest states for incarcerations, i.e. number of people in prison, is Louisiana and Alabama. The two lowest, Utah and North Dakota. Now, when you correlate that against the crime rates, you would expect that Louisiana and Alabama would have low crime rates because they've got most of the bad people in prison, and Utah and North Dakota would have, if not high crime rates, higher than the Louisiana and Alabama. But what we find is actually the inverse, that North Dakota, followed by Utah, has the lowest crime rates, and actually not quite the highest, but very close to the highest rates are in Louisiana and Alabama. Actually, Florida came out on top as the highest crime rate in the numbers that I were looking at. So in one sense, you know, you could say that the higher crime rates, you would expect more convicts, which just seems to hold true, but it doesn't seem that this tough on crime results in a lower crime rate or safer streets, as it would be. Now, if we expand this to Western nations in general, the U.S. has the highest incarceration rate of almost every other nation in the world. In fact, I think it is the highest per populace. But it also has the highest crime rate. Again, it seems that putting more people in prison for longer periods of time does not seem to correlate with lower crime rates.
So I'm not going to sort of disagree with the entire analysis, but it seems a little bit simplistic, just that there is a correlation, but seeing as how state laws differ from place to place and federal laws certainly differ between nations, you'd expect some other policies and conventions and even, you know, culture in both the judicial systems and in society in general to have an enormous impact on both the amount of crime in general as well as that's resulting in incarceration. And it's especially true for differences between what is classified as an incarceratable offense in different places.
So you actually, that's a very, very good point. And I think the main thrust that I'm trying to make a point here is you're right. Crime rates, incarceration numbers, that sort of thing is actually a very complex socioeconomic issue. But a lot of people, and again, where this started from, the Harper government, conservatives and that, seem to say, no, put them in prison and that will solve all of our problems. They want to say it's a very simple one-to-one correlation, when it isn't. And if anything, if you look at the numbers in more depth, the correlation works against what their simplistic analysis is.
Yeah, and I think it's important to recognize that the tough on crime policy doesn't seem to be any more effective than an alternative approach. Things like poverty, education, social services will all probably have a bigger impact than the number of prisons, which is the whole point, that prisons are not really useful in combating crime at all. And I also think it's really important to keep in mind that when we're discussing this, regardless of your political ideology or your stance on crime, the government, in our case, is making a claim that crime rates are rising, and they've offered a solution, that more prisons will lower the crime rate. So the burden of proof is therefore on them to prove that A, crime rates are in fact rising, and B, prisons will lower the crime rate. Now, because the current information that we have indicates that A, crime rate is not rising, and B, more prisons don't seem to lower the crime rate pretty much anywhere. The amount of evidence required to satisfactorily prove that the government is right would be really considerable here.
You know, in fact, in contrast to the increase in incarceration, if we look at Europe, where less emphasis is placed upon locking people up and more on rehabilitation, we get both a lower crime rate, in places half of that in Canada, as well as a declining prison population. In the Netherlands last year, they began shutting down the number of prisons due to overcapacity. And the money that they saved on prisons and in the construction, their upkeep, staffing, support of the inmates, can be applied to both preventative and rehabilitative measures. One number that I was looking at, the cost of a prisoner in Canada is anywhere from $150,000 to over $250,000 per day.
Per day.
Per day. Compared to community options, like community supervision, halfway houses, those sort of things, where it's like about $50 a day.
Well, I've got a solution. Keep them out of prison. Let's send them and 50 other people to university for a semester because, you know, I'm sure some people could certainly use the help from that 250 grand a day.
You know, one of my biggest fears about showing all this is that, you know, you're right. We shouldn't build more prisons. We should build more guillotines because that way we'll save the money and get rid of the criminals at the same time. No, this is not an effort to support capital punishment or the restoration of that. No.
Yeah, you know, I think that our discussion on this is really interesting. I mean, crime, punishment, prisons, it's a very complex, very big question. And as we've sort of been hinting at, there's so many different angles to look at this, whether we're trying to affect crime by reducing poverty or increase education or the whole tough on crime analysis. But we've really kept this focus to basically just prisons and the crime rate itself. And we can go on and on and on about what's the best method, whether it's or whether our system should be about punishing crime or rehabilitating crime. That's sort of a separate issue altogether.
Exactly. When I was doing the research for this, it was getting to points where I was being overwhelmed at the possibilities in there. I mean, as you point out, I mean, there's the causes of crime. There's the idea of racism in crime. I mean, that's a huge issue in Canada, considering the number of Aboriginal people in our prison system compared to the representation and population. There's also the whole idea of private versus public prisons and all that, the idea of real rehabilitation. It's a huge, huge topic. But as good skeptics, we try to focus on one particular issue and apply our skeptic skills, our idea of critical thinking, to try and approach this and come up, if not with a solution, at least a clearer vision of what it is we're actually looking at, as compared to so many people who just take ideological knee-jerk reactions, be it on the left, be it on the right, and ignore sort of the facts on the ground.
Absolutely. Well, we're pretty much out of time here. Let's go on to our skeptical highlights. Don, got a good one?
Yes. Well, apparently the Philosopher's Cafe is questioning consciousness. They're having a discussion about what is consciousness. How can we know for sure that what we know? Can we be certain that others are conscious? Is there a relationship between consciousness and conscience? Sorry. Thursday, September 1st at 7 p.m. at 1318 Cartwright Street on Granville Island. There'll be a link on our webpage. Admission is $5. Go in there and find out whether you are a zombie or a conscious individual.
All right. Jenna, you got one?
Who says zombies aren't conscious? I do. So the scientific magazine Nature Chemistry September edition has recently come out and has a section of articles that are meant to reflect on issues important to chemistry, but that really reach beyond bench research. So this includes effective communication and teaching in chemistry, stuff like gender issues and reflections on the place of big pharma in chemical research, as well as commentaries on chemistry and the developing world. So these commentaries are all free until the end of September, so you have a couple of days, and we'll have the link on the website. And you should go check them out because they're really well-written and meant to approach sort of the chemical society and people that do this research from a really broad perspective.
So this is already out?
Yeah.
So, like, are you being prophetic or something? Because you said it's a September issue. It's not September yet.
I know. It has come out.
Wow.
I know. You're going to have to take it up with the editor.
Wow. Okay, well, I got a skeptical highlight as well. The Humanist Peace Arch Picnic is coming up. This is a joint get-together with the BC Humanists and the HNPS, which is the Humanists of North Puget Sound, who are based in Bellingham, Washington. And the picnic is on Sunday, September 11th at 11 a.m., and it goes to 2 p.m. at the Peace Arch Park, number 19, Street in Blaine, Washington. The venue will be the American side of the park. For anyone who needs help getting to the picnic, rides will be leaving from the Oak Ridge Senior Center in Vancouver at 10 a.m. And we'll have a link to the event on our website, so check it out.
I thought it was quite interesting that the date happens to be on September 11th, and if there's going to be any, I don't know, skeptical angle on that. I was downloaded a documentary the other day from the BBC, I think it is, about the 10th anniversary of 9/11 and the conspiracy theories are revolving around it. And it just,
yeah, it might be a bit interesting trying to get to the USA on September 11th for a humanist picnic.
Yes,
but maybe just say that you're going down there to visit some friends. I don't know.
I was wondering why they couldn't get the picnic to straddle the border. That seems like it would be a really, really nice hand-holding gesture.
Well, I think it's practically doing that. It is at the Peace Arch Park, so it's as close as they're possibly going to get to doing that.
Yeah, I remember there's in Manitoba, there's sort of a peace park, and the bit in the middle, the border, so to speak, is all flowery and it's all things, whereas to actually sit down and eat something, you have to be on one or the other side because the middle part is sort of display.
Hmm. Well, we're out of time, so this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
Jenna reminding you that the real world is amazing.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.